Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. From Treasure Island to Pirates at Penzance to Peter Pan, at every stage of our life, as children and adults, we're treated to wonderfully entertaining stories of pirates. We know they once existed, and perhaps they still do. But what were they really like? What does history tell us about their lives on the high seas? In a moment, we'll talk to David Cordingly about the romance and reality of pirates. But before we do that, let's look back at this week in history. On February 4, 1945, President Franklin Roosevelt, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and Soviet Premier Joseph Stalin met at Yalta in southern Russia. The Allied leaders had met only once during World War II at Tehran, Iran, in 1943. When the Big Three met at Yalta, the war in Europe was nearly over. The Red Army had occupied most of Eastern Europe, and the American and British forces were poised to cross the Rhine into Germany. Looking forward to post-war Europe, the three leaders agreed that Germany would be divided into zones of occupation and would pay heavy reparations to the Soviet Union. All three leaders pledged free elections in the areas under their control at the end of the war, and the Soviet Union pledged to declare war on Japan as soon as Germany surrendered. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, we have two items related to pirates. First, legend has it that Black Sam Bellamy was on his way to rendezvous with a lover when his pirate ship was destroyed by a ferocious storm off Cape Cod, Massachusetts in 1717. Since then, the wreckage of his ship, the Widow, and most of its 5-ton cargo of gold and silver have eluded archaeologists. Recently, however, a tantalizing underwater trail of gold bars, coins, guns, and skeletons led researcher Barry Clifford to a perfectly preserved chunk of what appears to be the ship's hull. The discovery marks the most meaningful Widow find since 1984. When Clifford discovered artifacts, it indicated the ship was buried somewhere beneath the waves off the coast of Massachusetts. Those artifacts, by the way, are exhibited at Expedition Widow on McMillan Wharf in Provincetown. And Chilean authorities have approved a U.S. expedition to search for 18th-century pirate treasure on Robinson Crusoe Island. The unidentified expedition used data from satellites to find the spot where the English pirate Francis Drake is believed to have hidden his treasure. We'll hear more about pirates when we return in a moment. Black Sam Bellamy, Francis Drake, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard, pirates all, and the source of so many wonderful stories. But are they true? Historians are working on that question, trying to set the record straight, and we have one of the most prominent of those historians with us today, David Cordingly. Here to interview Cordingly from his home in England is Creighton historian Eileen Dugan.
Ask anyone between the ages of 5 and 75 to describe a pirate, and you'll get the same general elements. Long hair, long coat, armed to the teeth with a cutlass and a pistol or two, a wooden leg, a parrot on his shoulder, a treasure map in his pocket, and the skull and crossbones flag fluttering over his head. His habit of making people walk the plank makes him a bit menacing, but oddly, in a jovial sort of way. Pirates, we believe, are romantic, harmless types. But does this popular image of pirates have any correspondence to reality? With us to discuss the historical pirate is Mr. David Cordingly, author of Under the Black Flag, The Romance and Reality of Life Among the Pirates. Mr. Cordingly is a past curator and head of exhibitions at the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, England, and is the author of numerous books and articles on maritime history. He talks with us today from his home in Sussex, England. Welcome, Mr. Cordingly.
Hello.
Why do we find pirates so romantic?
Well, I think it's really all the fault of the novelists, particularly, obviously, Robert Louis Stevenson with Treasure Island, and then backed up by things like Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance, and, of course, Peter Pan with Captain Hook. And I think this romantic image of pirates has become so associated with fiction that we forget that behind the fiction that we see on the stage and on the screen with Errol Flynn and that sort of thing, there were very real people who were not at all romantic and quite unpleasant and terrifying beings.
Now, how close is this common image that we have to reality? I mean, did they really walk around with parrots on their shoulders? They stomp around on peg legs? Did they bury treasure and make people walk on the plank and all of that?
Well, some of it's true and some of it isn't. I mean, walking the plank we can dismiss straight away. I mean, that was not something that parrots did. I have come across one example, but on the whole, they dealt with their prisoners and victims in a far more summary way. I mean, they did maroon people on desert islands. That was a fairly common thing to do with victims, but not make them walk the plank. Parrots are easy, again, to deal with. Parrots were simply, as far as seamen were concerned, and remember, most pirates were seamen, they were simply souvenirs that you brought back home when you were in the tropics, and there are numerous examples of both pirates and ordinary seamen bringing back parrots with them. As for peg legs, well, again, like seamen, pirates had a difficult time at sea. They could fall out of the rigging, they could get injured in battle, and so obviously a proportion of pirates lost legs and arms and sometimes eyes and would have to have an eye patch as well.
What about buried treasure? Is that true as well in treasure maps?
Well, the treasure is tricky, really. I mean, the Captain Kidd is believed to have buried some treasure on Gardner's Island outside New York. But if he did bury it, it was certainly all dug up again fairly soon after that. And there's very, very few examples that I've come across of pirates burying their treasure. And there's no reason why they should have done so, really. I mean, a pirate, his basic aim in life was to get as rich quick and to have an easy life and to get drunk and to have women and to generally have a good time. And so he wanted to spend his money and to drink up the treasure if it was in the form of rum, or spend the gold if it was in the form of gold.
Now, why did men become pirates in the first place? I mean, did they choose to become pirates, or were they forced into piracy?
Well, that's difficult to say one thing, really. I mean, there are numerous different reasons why men became pirates. I mean, the most basic reason was simply an economic necessity. I mean, on the verge of starvation, possibly a merchant seaman who was out of work, or a Royal Naval seaman who was made redundant by the Navy when in a time of peace. Their only skill was sailing a ship, and so they would take to piracy and rob ships simply to be able to survive. There's no doubt that a large proportion of men who became pirates were forced into piracy, and for one reason or another took to the life, either because once they become a pirate it was difficult, if you were likely to be hanged if you were caught anyway. And the other thing was that, of course, living life on a pirate ship, on the whole, certainly in the Caribbean, was a lot easier and a more pleasant life than being either in the Navy or in a merchant ship, where you had to work hard and heave on ropes all day long. And a pirate's life was relatively easy.
Yeah, you mentioned, for example, that actually there would be more men on a pirate ship than on your typical Navy or merchant marine ship.
Well, not so much on a naval ship, but certainly on a merchant ship. I mean, merchant ships were run by their owners, obviously with as few members of the crew as possible, because then they'd save money. So on a merchant ship, you'd often have only 10 or 20 men, whereas a pirate ship of the same size could have 50 or 100 men, because the pirates would fill a merchant ship if they captured it with guns, and you needed 4 to 6 men to operate each gun. So a pirate ship coming up against a merchant ship usually won the battle without even having to fight. But no, naval ships had big crews, and the very few examples of a pirate ship voluntarily deciding to attack a naval ship.
Now, you mentioned that it was a very hard, very dangerous life. What would happen to an injured man? I mean, did pirates have sort of, workman's compensation for missing eyes and limbs?
Yes, they did. There's one of the interesting things about pirates, and there's been a lot of sort of philosophical discussion about this, about pirates being the sort of early revolutionaries and all this sort of thing. There's no doubt that the pirates did have among themselves a form of democracy, which at its basic form simply involved voting the captain into office and out of office if he wasn't a good captain, a practice that would, of course, been unheard of in the Navy or indeed on a merchant ship. And they also had a series of articles, which were rules that were laid down for the sort of governing of their life. And one of the things there was that the treasure must be equally divided out among them in a democratic way, and also that pirates who were injured in battle should get compensation. So money was put into a sort of common pot, and a pirate who lost an arm or a leg then drew some of the money from that common source of money as compensation. And so there was certainly, it was a form of medical insurance in a way.
Now, were pirates, when they were on their raids, just after gold and silver, or were they after other things?
Well, I mean, the image of pirates is that all they were interested in was pieces of eight and doubloons and that sort of thing, or treasure chests, you know, groaning with pearls and emeralds and things. In fact, it is very interesting when you look into the records of what was actually taken. I mean, there's a lot of evidence about piracy from captains and seamen who were captured by pirates and then let go. And then they would give a sort of deposition to the nearest colonial governor and let him know what was going on. And the evidence is that pirates, in fact, would strip a ship basically of anything useful. I mean, obviously they wanted gold and silver if they could get it, because that was worth something to them. But they often simply went for drink, and surprisingly, they would simply go for household goods to keep them going, food. They'd steal any goats or cattle on board. And then replacement gear for the ship, so that they would steal anchors, ropes, sails, and so on and so forth. It's surprising, really, that a typical pirate haul wasn't quite as romantic as one would think.
And sometimes they would even take the ships and sort of deconstruct them and rebuild them?
Yes, they would. I mean, a pirate had to start with something, so what they would often do, I mean, the general pattern would be that pirates would perhaps row across to an anchored ship at night in a harbour, steal the ship out of the harbour, and then use that ship to sort of trade up to a larger ship. So they would then arm the ship heavily and go and attack another ship that was perhaps bigger and faster, as far as they were concerned. And somebody like Bartholomew Roberts had four or five ships during the course of his piratical career. So that was the system, usually.
And sometimes they would also take specific officers or specific crew members off the ships as well, right?
Yes, they did. Pirates were dependent on, obviously, getting more pirates to fill the ranks. And it's very interesting. Again, this is very well documented, that when a pirate ship attacked a merchant ship or even a naval ship, if they did manage to capture some members of a naval ship's crew, they would attempt to force to join them those members of the crew who had specific skills. So a cooper who could make barrels, or somebody who would navigate, or a surgeon, or a ship's carpenter, were all useful to them. They had specific skills that they could use, and they would often be forced to join the pirate crew against their will.
Now, we have from movies a very romantic idea of how pirates treated their victims, and
uh-huh.
I mean, there's the image, for example, of Tyrone Power in The Black Swan, Captain Jamie wooing the woman that he's captured. But how did pirates really treat their victims?
Well, one can't really generalize, but on the whole, they treated their victims not well. they did. There are numerous examples of pirates using torture and violence to, in the course of robbing ships. They obviously would rape women if they came across them, and seize women and take them along with them. Though there was an interesting rule among some of the pirates that you shouldn't take a woman to sea, presumably for the same reason that the Navy felt that a woman among the crew caused disruption. Though there were famously several women pirates, but not very many of them. But all the men who were actually captured by pirates and who subsequently gave accounts, and women as well, all wrote of their terrifying experience. They would describe the casual violence. They all remarked on the horrendous violence and the sort of anarchic atmosphere in a pirate crew, and the fact that the pirates got heavily drunk on numerous occasions, so that it was sort of noise, violence, drink, and torture was what you could expect if you found yourself on a pirate crew.
Now, you suggest that the makers of pirate movies, when they romanticize the stories of, say, Blackbeard or Captain Kidd, many times they miss a story that's at least as dramatic by not depicting the reality of their lives. How so?
Well, in a way, what has happened with the pirate movies is it's as if they've been dreamt up by a committee, and indeed the same. This certainly goes for a recent one called Cutthroat Island, when the actors are terrific, the locations are good, the stunts are wonderful, but the story is totally unbelievable and messy, and doesn't sort of hang together. And the fact is that you take a man like Bartholomew Roberts, the Welsh pirate. I mean, his life was a saga, really, ending up in a dramatic battle off the coast of Africa in a gale, and then he was shot, and his body was thrown overboard, and all the crew were then hauled before a naval tribunal in Cape Coast Castle. And similarly, Captain Kidd's life, if you read the life in detail, it's infinitely more exciting. It has more sort of romance and tragedy in it than the various films that have been made of Captain Kidd. And the Blackbeard film with Robert Newton is just a bit of a joke, really. I mean, one can't take it terribly seriously because the character is a sort of jovial pantomime character rather than being this very alarming character who Blackbeard was. So, you know, in a way, one wishes the filmmakers would study the lives of the pirates and pick one and say, right, we'll go for him and keep it reasonably true to life.
Well, do you have a favourite pirate story?
Well, I suppose one's favourite pirate has to be Calico Jack, simply because he was the pirate, John Rackham, who on his crew, he managed to get two women pirates, and they are so unusual, and the story is so well documented that I go for him every time, because he wasn't a dramatic pirate. He was what I would call a small-time pirate. But when captured off the coast of Jamaica, people were astonished to find two women among the crew, dressed as men, in fact. And then there was this sensational trial in Port Royal, at which the no less a person than the governor of Jamaica was the president of the Admiralty Court. And then a big fuss when the two women are tried and then plead the fact that they're pregnant, and so they're reprieved. But the whole story is terrific, really, and again would make I think a wonderful movie.
Now, what led to the decline of what we might consider the golden age of pirating?
Well, it was what in fact happened was that during the early 1720s, piracy became such a menace, particularly around the Bahamas and up the eastern seaboard of America, that the colonial governors, as they then were, and merchants, were writing back to London and saying, you've got to do something about it. That the Royal Navy at that stage, because the American Navy was then hardly in existence, the Royal Navy was really the only force that could send battleships across the Atlantic in sufficient numbers to do anything about it. The Admiralty was persuaded that the piracy was a major problem, so they sort of stopped fighting their wars in Europe and turned their attention to piracy. And what happened was medium-sized naval ships were sent to the coast of America and to the West Indies and also down the coast of Africa, and they systematically searched out the pirates, and they, in some cases, fought them to a standstill. And they made it no longer worthwhile being a pirate, because having captured a pirate crew, the authorities were extremely tough and instituted what you might call show trials, and would hang the majority of the crew in public, of course, at the water's edge. And then the bodies would then be publicly displayed on gibbets at the water's edge, so that it no longer became worth being a pirate. And having tracked them down, hanged the ringleaders, I think the majority of pirates decided, well, we've had enough of this, and they turned to other things.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Cordingley. We've been talking with Mr. David Cordingley, author of Under the Black Flag, The Romance and Reality of Life Among the Pirates.
Come listen a while, and you soon shall hear of a comely maiden, I do declare. Her father followed the smuggling trade like a warlike hero. Like a warlike hero, she never was afraid.
Ah, life at sea, of sailors and pirates, how dramatic and romantic. How masculine. What a male bonding experience. But what about the women? That's right. There seems to have been women sailors and pirates, too, centuries ago. Here to tell us about them in Talking History's Op-Ed of the Week is Diane Dugaw, professor of English at the University of Oregon. Dugaw is the author of Warrior Woman and Popular Balladry, published by the University of Chicago Press in 1996. She has titled her op-ed for us today, Woman Sailors in Folk Songs and History.
London, February 1835. A young sailor reveals himself to be Anne Thornton, a bold teenage girl from Donegal who sailed the Atlantic as cabin boy, cook, and steward. The London Times reports, for 31 months she engaged in these remarkable adventures. A printed song sheet describes her as one of the most extraordinary strong-minded girls that ever lived. Though no doubt extraordinary, Anne Thornton was not unique. She stands in a long line of women who fought and sailed in real life and starred in popular songs and tales. She was a female warrior. The female warrior is a high-mettled heroine of ballads and stories, both fictional and true, who masquerades as a man and ventures to war or to sea. While most of these songs feature women in armies and navies of earlier times, a few, like the female smuggler, celebrate women pirates. Female warrior ballads were pop song hits for nearly three centuries. The earliest, an Elizabethan bestseller from the 1590s, stayed popular for 200 years. More than 120 other female warrior songs appeared in print until well into the 1800s. And ballads passed on orally turn up in folk song collections right up to our own day. How much truth was there to such accounts? Carrie Grover of Nova Scotia sang songs about women sailors in 1941 for the Library of Congress. Asked if she ever had daydreams about doing such a thing, she answered, "I sure did. I imagine things like this happened in the days gone by. But now they've got laws, so they couldn't get away with it." As Carrie Grover suspected, women like Anne Thornton did get away with it. In 18th century England, several women sailors carried tales of their adventures onto the stage. The exploits of the legendary women buccaneers Anne Bonny and Mary Read were included in an account of the robberies and murders of the most notorious pirates, published in 1724. One of the first acts of the U.S. Congress in the 1790s awarded a pension to Deborah Sampson, a Massachusetts woman who fought in the Revolutionary War as Robert Shurtleff. Some 400 women were among American Civil War casualties. The female warrior, heroine of songs, legends, and history, opens our eyes to the lives and ideals of the past and to ways that our own experiences and potentials are shaped and imagined. Though hidden away in old songs and stories, masquerading heroines like Anne Thornton or the pirates Anne Bonny and Mary Read are not so far-fetched. Ask any little girl who has stuffed her ponytail up inside her cowboy hat to stride out into the wide world.
You've been listening to Diane Dugaw, author of Warrior Woman and Popular Balladry, published by the University of Chicago Press. Welcome back. For our historic site of the week, continuing on the subject of pirates, we've selected the New England Pirate Museum, which hails itself as an historical adventure for young and old. Here to tell us about this unique museum is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Located in Salem, Massachusetts, the New England Pirate Museum is an experience you won't soon forget. You can mingle with the swashbucklers of old as you walk the dockside village, board their ship, and witness the battles, and explore the Bat Cave, an 80-foot cave with hidden treasures. Notorious pirate captains such as Kidd, Blackbeard, Bellamy, and Quelch roamed the waters off Boston's North Shore, known as the Gold Coast, during the 17th and 18th centuries. Like many people today, they spent their summers in the north and wintered in the tropics. Their ill-gotten booty is believed to have been buried offshore on the islands that dot the New England coast. The 20 to 30 minute walking tour is an exciting adventure and an interesting history lesson.
Finally, we turn to our weekly list of coming attractions of a historical nature. For an interesting look at American music, you may want to visit the George and Ira Gershwin exhibit at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. This tribute to the Gershwin brothers' contributions to American music includes George's piano and desk, Ira's typing table, self-portraits of each brother, and other documents that chronicle their lives and careers. Porgy and Bess will be featured for the first few months of the exhibition, as well as a selection of musical manuscripts from other Gershwin stage and screen shows. For further information, contact the Library of Congress. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week when we will talk about the history of Mardi Gras. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Come listen a while, and you soon shall hear of a comely maiden, I do declare. Her father followed the smuggling trade like a warlike hero. Like a warlike hero, she never was afraid. With two loaded pistols, she went on board. Down by her side hung a glittering sword. In her belt two daggers well armed for war stood the female smuggler. Stood the female smuggler, saying, I never feared a scar. They had not sailed long on the deep before they spied that Turkish fleet. They are sea robbers, young Jane did cry, but said she to her father, but said she to her father,